Welcome everyone to the Faith Tech Podcast. My name is James Kelly. I help lead this global tech community for Christ we call Faith Tech. And I had the awesome conversation with the Joshua K. Smith, or as his friends call him, K. Smith. I actually just made that up. I have no idea. but I call him Josh. Josh has got such a cool background. He wrote a book called Robot Theology, Old Questions Through New Media, and he's got a PhD in theology. He did his dissertation in robotic futurism, dehumanization. He's a senior pastor of a local church in Mississippi. He's actually working on a book right now on the connection between violence and technology. And so just love his heart. He's got this pastoral heart, and our conversation bleeds into all sorts of cool realms. We talk about, what role is robots? And we define that pretty broadly, but we got into this conversation around the use of chatbots for evangelism, which I found really intriguing. He really does come at this conversation from a pastoral heart. So he shares a word of encouragement for any of us that are engaged really deeply in technology or building technology. We talked about the ethical dilemma of innovating technology when your intent was good, but it leads to evil. And he's got some good frameworks around formation and deformation and substitution versus supplement use of technology. And then we ended with a conversation about the movie WALL-E and the movie Her, as understanding the role of where we're going in terms of this world, dystopian, utopian. I mean, just good, fun stuff, but also deep, important in the way we're thinking about this stuff. So hope you enjoy this conversation. Here we go, my conversation with Joshua K. Smith. K. Smith? No, we don't use that language here. Okay, here we go. Well, Josh, thanks for taking the time, man, to have this conversation with me. Thankful for you, the work, the thinking you've been doing. And just as we are even setting up to have this call, we're dealing with all this technology issues, mm-hmm. right? Of like, this mm-hmm. platform's not working, this audio's not working. And I was just like laughing as we were just praying around how, and this is such a good example of how important it is that we try to figure out how does technology work, both I think really practically, but really the workings of it underneath that sits. And I think that's what gets me excited to chat with you, man. So thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks, James, for being open to the conversation and willing to have answer and discuss process questions with me. I'm always grateful.
I wanted to jump right into things because right at the outset of your book, there's this really intriguing quote. David O'Hara says this. He says, Pandora's Facebook box has been opened. I don't know if robots can be priests, but some are beginning to function as priests. This calls for care on our part, and I don't think it is wise to expect a machine to care on our behalf. Now, what was kind of the thinking behind kind of getting that right at the outset of the book? How does that kind of represent some of your bigger overarching thinking around this space of robotic theology?
Yeah, well, I start with Dave and I end with Dave in a way in chapter 7. And Dave was really helpful. Had a lot of great insight for me. He was a conversation partner. And I think, I don't know how Dave and I got connected through Twitter, but he wrote that article, Can Robots Be Priests, or something to that effect. But it was really interesting. It helped me to kind of process my own thoughts. And so I wanted to include Dave at the forefront, just as a thank you for kind of helping me think about the question a little bit deeper, and then also being a sounding board for some of the ideas. Because as you know, James, there's not much literature from our circles about this question. And I think it's a very, pragmatic concern about, how could we use robots? And in the West, in the Eastern world, it's more open. The box is not beginning to open. It has been opened. And robots are just a very integrated part of society, either by pragmatics or because the philosophy in the East allows more for it. But I wanted to include Dave for a lot of reasons, but that's primarily why I started with that quote, is to get us to think it's not a question for 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the road. Yeah. It's a question for right now, that whether or not robots are integrated in a healthy way, it matters right now, not just 100 years from now. And not whether or not they're sentient, which is like the big question that everybody always goes to, you know, or would they think like humans? And that's really not the best question for me. That's not where I wanted to start. And I wanted to reframe everything and to really begin to press people to think about, you know, more of the hand of the robot versus the mind. And a priest, if you think about it, and a pastor, I'm a pastor too. You know, we do a lot more with our hands, or supposed to. You know, we're supposed to be the hands and feet of Christ, not the brain of Christ. And so I know that's kind of stretching what you're saying, but it's all about the practical, ethical implications of how I live. And of course, life of the mind is important in Christian faith, and that's what we're doing right now, right? You know, so and that's a lot of what I do is think about these things, but not just think about them philosophically in an abstract way, but in a down to earth way. How's this development going to impact, you know, truck drivers in my church? How's it going to impact the people right. that work in law enforcement, the nurses, people that are retired who are already struggling on the margins?
Right.
And, you know, like I think about all those things. And so I think the robot as priest is, and I'm sure we'll get to this question later, more about how do we fix something in the here and now as kind of a band-aid approach to some of the anthropological problems that we're having around economy and war and, you know, just lots of different things. It's like, well, let's just put a machine in that mix, but that makes it more complicated, not less complicated. And so Dave just had a really great way of framing that for me. And still to this day, he's just a great philosopher.
I think what you've laid out there, which is so core to this whole thing, is identifying the depth of this problem. And I think we could get into this, and it's kind of like, okay, robot theology. And I think even my next question is going to be defining robot. But I think what you've identified, though, which is so fundamental, is why it's important we're talking about these things, because of the implications. Like, I remember 5-6 years ago when I started into these conversations of faith and technology, I wrote this submission paper for a conference at Faith and Work Movement. Faith and Work New York City was doing the Center for Faith and Work. And I my profession pre-faith tech is as a recruiting consultant. And I said, what are the implications of technology on the job market? And one of my results was the implications on the poor and how much it's going to affect the poor when you actually look at things like transportation robotics. And there was all these things. And I found it so fascinating that what I had never really thought of, which was, oh, let's just innovate. Let's just build technology. Its implications on each choice we make there is pretty dramatic. So thanks for kind of laying out that groundwork of how important this conversation is. Going back to that other question I had then, I think when I hear robot theology, when I first kind of pick up your book, I'm like, you know, he's thinking about iRobot, like the movie iRobot, you know, or Terminator or something, right? But the examples you already gave are far breadth beyond that. So how are you defining even that? Like, let's bring a theology to this definition of a robot. What's the kind of that definition there?
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to do is to think theologically about robots. And so to take my framing of the Bible and my evangelical perspective of what the Bible is, what it means, how we've received it, and how we interpret it and apply it, and then use that as a lens to look at AI and robots from a theological perspective. And I think it's a very confusing, I wanted to like title to be short, And there's already a couple of papers called A Theology of Robots. And so I was just like, let's just put these two together. I'm not saying like, yeah, robots as priests and, that type of thing, but how might we integrate some of these applications or algorithms or whatever into our own working structures of faith and institutions without going too far, without being a Luddite in a way,
Right.
being optimistic about our tools and technologies, and also understanding that there is a redemptive part to
Yes.
technology that we often lose sometimes, I think, in our Christian heritage, that we once believed that technology and these tools would bring in some type of utopia. And I'm dealing more with that now in my current work, but it's not something that gets talked about a lot. Like, that is a part of our faith, and we were these very optimistic people and driven to use these tools as a way to develop. And then it kind of gets away from us. And we go through the modern era, and technology starts to take on a very different approach. And then you get the pessimism of people like Alul and others who are like, well, maybe we, there's no hope in it. And so I'm just trying to say, look, there are redemptive aspects to it, but then there are some technologies that are very destructive and hurtful. And so just trying to help the user understand it. And I'm not just talking about the fringe stuff, sex robots and stuff like that. But I mean, even in the technology that we use every day, James, it can be very harmful if we're not informed and if we're not educated about how some things, even like a web browser collecting information and data on me and my family and posting photos of my children and stuff, how that might be used for harm. And all that stuff now we're learning is so powerful, and we don't really think about it. And so that's what I'm trying to do through robots. So I'm still learning. I don't have it all like neatly compartmentalized, or and so I think the more that I write, the more that I learn and read and discuss with others, the more I'm kind of finding out where the balance is. And so that whole framework of what I'm trying to do in that book was just to, it's like, hey, what are some of the major categories that robots might help us rethink about some things in anthropology? And so that's kind of where I launch from.
Going to, yeah, thanks for that. Going to this back, even back to the Dave's quote there of robot priests, it actually made me think of we're aware of different chatbots that are being used in the process of evangelism. And I think this is a really fascinating question around what role does technology and robots play in the process of evangelism and discipleship. So the example here is, say you post a piece of content on social media and then someone engages with that, and that content could be like, oh, have you had a dream about Jesus? And then when they get into the conversation, it's actually a chatbot that they're engaging with. And this chatbot is deployed with and holds, all of scripture and all sorts of Q&A questions that it's pulled from online and different commentaries. And as people start asking questions about who is Jesus, you're quoting scripture, and that the chatbot is actually doing this work. And even to the point where the chatbot will say something like John 3:16, and then the person will ask an intriguing question. They'll say, do you want to come to know Jesus? And the person replies, yes, I do. And then they say, let's pray together, and they quote a prayer through a chatbot. And like, you can see how this goes all the way down to like, this person just came to faith through a chatbot. And that stuff's actually happening. There's actually ministries that are deploying chatbots right now that are doing this kind of this work. And that sounds like a robot priest, in some regards to me. And so just curious to know if there's a way of thinking about this stuff, because telling that story on one hand, someone would be like, that's ridiculous. That's the poor use of robots. That's not safe enough. There's no human interaction there. On the other side, someone would say, that's the best use of technology I've ever heard in my life. How do we think about that? How do you, would you kind of process some of that with your thinking?
I think many times what we want to do is to make that easier, or to streamline that. I'm not saying that's necessarily wrong, but my struggle with it would be, okay, if we offload that, are we in some ways subverting our call to be those hands and feet and to use and implement as a means of connection? Great, you know, as a means of, you know, trying to mediate the distance that we have between people. And I know ministries that I think are really great that use online chat rooms as like a way for people to reach out in therapy. And and whether or not, you know, we use a chat bot at the forefront of that, I mean, that's fine. But I think ultimately I'd like it to see, me personally, it end up in with a human interaction. And so whatever interface that we're using, I mean, that I don't have a problem with that, but I don't know. I guess the biggest problem would be, you know, are we offloading that responsibility onto a chat? And I'm not necessarily okay with that, or I don't think that's the ideal. I think there might be situations, I'm sure there are, where that might be the only outlet. And then I think about my friends who have come to know God through their dreams. You know, they had no physical missionary or friend or person in their family. You know, they may have grown up in a very hostile religion. I won't say which one, but I mean, I know people personally that have come to faith through dreams. And so who am I to say that somebody can't come to faith through a chatbot? That's fine. But that's always going to be the first step in a very long process of discipleship. And so if we're going to make on ramps for faith that way, that's fine. But that cannot be, in my opinion, the way that we do discipleship primarily.
And this sounds a little bit like the language you use around substitution versus supplement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And I think it's a gradient, right? Like, it's not going to be a black and white line, like, oh, we did this, now we've automatically it's bad. But you know, I think we're always, as humans, kind of approaching a threshold and looking at it and saying, okay, should I cross this boundary? What happens when I walk through that door? Kind of goes back to Dave's thoughts about the Pandora's box. You know, once we open it and start integrating it, and then we see a little bit of pragmatic results from it, I think then it takes on a different life. And they're like, oh, well, you know, how can we say that it's bad when people are coming to faith? Well, it's not that it's bad, like in its nature or anything like that. It's just, are we bringing in more people to faith than we can faithfully disciple? And so, and I even think about this as in, like, you know, when people have these big crusades and stuff like we have in the States, where say hundreds of people come to faith in an area, who's going to disciple those people? Because that's the end game, right? It's not just conversion, but conversion and discipleship. And so that's how I would challenge people to think about these tools as well. Is it's not just about how you bring people on as an on-ramp, but how are you going to like integrate them into the faith, into this society, this embodied world? That's what discipleship is. It can't, you know, like, and so we just think very practically about some of these things. And I think there will be cases where, okay, maybe we go to this place, or we don't have missionaries in that area, we don't have literature in that language. Well, hey, we can use some mediation there, right? We can try to use it in that way. But also, James, we keep integrating more and more and more tech. But does it really make things easier, or is it just adding another barrier and frustration to our life? And that I am a slow, wet network, right? I need to process things slower. I need to be in a place where I can absorb vitamin D, and artificial light is great, you know, right. But man, I think the simplicity of just life on life discipleship gets just diminished in some ways when, you know, God wanted this to be costly to us. And I'm not saying that virtual stuff is not costly. It is. Sometimes it's even more frustrating than just getting on a plane, going to sit with James. Like, it would have been a much better conversation, right? We could have had some great coffee together and had dinner. Just a much better experience. But it is costly, right? So I think it's always a balancing act, James. I don't want to demonize any piece of tech that might be used for gospel advancement, or I think just learning to put it, as Andy Crouch says, in its proper place is really the hard part. There are systems that are really hurtful, and they're very simple systems that are not extremely complicated. But because our focus is on Terminator or Skynet or something like that, I think sometimes we miss the simple things and the small things that are really hurting people. And I think taking a ministry, for example, and just saying like, well, we're only gonna towards online church, or we're only gonna push towards these types of ministries, which I would call like disembodied. And I know there's problems with that term, but I should have a problem with that, because there's a lot of people who need that embodiment, who don't understand, who have not fully accepted that yet. And we do both at our church. We try to reach out through social media, and I don't like it personally, but we put my sermons online and stuff like that. And I know other pastors in the area watch, and they grab stuff here and there, and I have my own problems with that. But that's kind of the yin and yang of it, is you minister to people who are shut in. That's kind of why we justify doing it. But then it also bleeds over to people who are just like, well, I'm not going to go back if I can watch this online, and that's true. Like we say, oh, it's so reductionistic, but it's true. Like if people say that, and they're like, well, I'll just watch a preacher on TV, and that's good enough for me. And I'm like, but it's not just
That's
about that, man. It's
totally.
there's so much more to it.
And this is where we as Faith Tech actually doubled down on the in-person. So when COVID hit, I remember a number of people in conversations like, oh, this is a huge opportunity that you could build something really big kind of online. And obviously we did a series of global hackathons and online things and tried to explore a lot of that. But coming out of it, and even early on, I did a ton of research on embodiment, a theology of embodiment, and really, really good hard work. But I really am now doubling down on the value of being in the flesh with somebody. And again, that doesn't mean we can't do things like this, where you and I get to have a conversation where it'd be incredibly difficult to try to make that work in person. So there's moments, no doubt. But the value of a hug, the value of seeing, eye to eye, the value of taking in a surrounding with another human, that shared experience of a surrounding, those are, I think, deeply embedded things that the Lord's given us to experience and to have. And so, yeah, I think those are key. I think too, this conversation gets into this ethical dilemma around innovating something with the intent of good that leads to evil, and then you're kind of stuck with it in the sense of, like, historically, how many people have innovated with technology and then regretted the innovation that they made because of its negative use on society, essentially a sinful people culturally. Take anything, and we'll find ways to turn it into evil. And I'm wondering, if there's some ways of thinking about some of this, because I think you can go one of a couple ways. Like, you can hear that and go, I'm never going to innovate then, because I don't want anything I create or anything I'm engaged with be taken for evil, and therefore I'm just not going to engage at all, right? And I think you can swing the other way. And the other camp goes, well, it's not up to me. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to go full steam ahead. And this is the allure of the startup world. This is why we as Faith Tech, when we're building technology, try to say, well, take moments of like lament
along the way of building a product and try to really go deeper, thinking ahead on the ethical implications of what you're building and creating. So I know, is there some ways of thinking about that as we think about creating and engaging in technology out of the fear of it might be used to, rather than help our society, it gets then, it aids in destroying it.
I think this question goes back to more philosophical discussion about what is the good, and even with design. And Derek Sherman, in his new book, was co-authored with a couple other people who are all engineers.
Dr. D,
Yeah,
love
man.
Derek.
That his new book is about design and how to think about it. And he gives they give a couple of questions in chapter three that are really good. So I would first, for any engineers or designers, managers, whatever side you're on, I definitely check out his new book. But one of the things is, how much time do we have to really think about and design? If you're working for a company, you're trying to put food on the table, you've got things to do, you've got marks to meet. When you're designing something, and anybody who's ever worked with tech knows it's complicated to get it to work like it's supposed to work. And sometimes it does things that you don't understand, and not that it has a mind of its own or anything like that, but and like you're saying, people may take your algorithm or your code and use it for things that you never made it for. And I've talked to engineers and students who've been offered money to sell their code for things that will be used in weapon systems. And so I think more universities are picking up on the need to have this philosophy of ethical design kind of integrated into the curriculum. And so, man, I just want to champion that so much. And this is the whole point of philosophy, is not to, or it, or even theology. They didn't used to be separated, and I don't really see them as separate. Is that we're not sitting around thinking about how many angels can dance on the head, or the head of a needle, but to really think about, okay, what is the good life? How do I make something good? There's a philosopher who asks, and he's very pessimistic, but he talks about the shape of design, and he talks about the submarine. And the submarine was meant to be the technology designed to take over the world, if you really think about what it is. This escape from atomic blast, and this escape from, all kinds of war and things like that, the apocalypse, so to speak. And he says there's basically no way to design it for good because of what it is, right? And so, can we say a nuclear bomb is a good design? And I would really challenge us in the modern age to really think about that, especially when it comes to AI and advanced robots, because really what AI is about deception, and it's supposed to make us question, am I talking to a human person or an artificial person? And now I think when we get to like imagination and playfulness and play in general, man, those can be really good things. They can be really helpful things. But when it's manipulative, then it be, and that's where the money is, right? That's where the profit comes in, and that's what drives some of these systems. And I think then we can start to form a philosophy of resistance, so to speak. Not that we can fully change the outcome, but that, as a faith community, like there are some things we might want to resist, in regards to AI. And by resist, I mean like, hey, maybe we shouldn't make those things. Maybe we shouldn't. And I think about how these things are going to be used in policing, and how they're going to be used in other in the gig economy and different things like that. We already see that it can be problematic, and we're not even, getting more advanced, into the more advanced systems. And so I don't know. I think we just need more time to reflect on what we're making and where, to the positive side of sci-fi, which is trying to get us to think about, hey, like how far down the line do we really want to go in this creation? And even going back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, just because we can make something doesn't mean we should.
Right.
And what we thought might be a beautiful creation, may turn and not turn just against us, but it's kind of digging into the story. But one, Victor had no right to make that creature. And then two, after he made it, he had no right to abandon it, which he did. And that's what makes it a monster, right? It's not the fact that it's this ugly creation or that it's not what he thought, but like, okay, as we're creating, if it turns bad, if it's ugly, like what are we going to do with it? And how are we going to protect people? And how are we going to mitigate loss and harm and all those things? And so it's not just about abandoning all this stuff or running and hiding in the woods or something, but we've already made a lot of harmful systems, and we've already given ourselves over to this culture of bigger, better, faster, more creation, more consumption. And so I think now we need to start thinking, well, how are we going to mitigate some of this harm and destruction and loss? And we fueled that. And so I think we just kind of got to go back to some of the basics of in our philosophy and theology of, what is the good? What were we created to do? Man, we were made to be gardeners, to make things flourish. And is there a way for us to possibly remake these tools? And I think about Isaiah and the plowshares and pruning hooks quote. Is there a way to make a lethal autonomous weapon system or a Reaper drone? Is there a way to refashion that into something good? I think some of those systems, it's going to be a hard no. And in some of those systems, yes. I think so. We just have to get other designers and engineers to not buy the lie that they're stuck in a fatalistic system
Nice.
of create, create, create until you die because you have to do it,
Yeah.
because like you don't have to. You are not fated to that, and God will help you and sustain you. And it's supposed to be a challenge. It's supposed to be hard. That word toil means painful work, right? You're supposed to work the ground hard. And even if we get the most complicated and advanced robots, like with the depictions in Westworld and stuff,
Right.
even then they're going to be broken systems, and they're going to, like in their own way, fail their designer. And so because the whole ground is cursed, and they all this stuff comes from the ground. It doesn't come from a magical cloud, right? And so and I think there's a reason why God, and this is a bigger theological question, hides beautiful things in some of the darkest and deepest places, right? And even within us, he calls us jars of clay. And if you know what those clay jars were used for in the ancient world, it's not something pretty. So Paul says he puts his treasure in jars of clay. He puts the treasure of the gospel in us, and we are the jars of clay. So there's so much redemption in us. There's so much
It's beautiful.
possibility. Yeah, there's so much beauty in ugly things that we make, and even just as humans, we know that to be true. Like we can be the most artistic, beautiful, loving, kind, generous people, but we can also be the most destructive and mean and hateful creatures. Like it's just so bizarre. But God, I think in our design, in how he made the world and the environment, it was a good thing. So I want people to understand that even if you make bad things, even if you And I've been in that process, I'm still struggling with that process and going through my own journey to overcome buying into that lie that, you know, well, I want to be a warrior. I want to be these things. I want to be a world destroyer. And, you know, and God helped me through that. And so I think we are destroying God's good creation in a lot of ways by the process of what we're making and designing. But I was just, that's a really long answer to what you asked, James, but just to not buy that myth of, you know, we have to make, we have to create, and to really step back and say, it's okay. It's okay to not make a new iPhone next year. It's okay to not keep making processors smaller. We really are tied together from the basis, like the smallest of molecules. We are tied together to this world that was made by God. And everything in creation is trying to help us see. Every struggle is a reminder that you are a finite being. And your time is limited. So let's make things for sure. Let's do that. Let's try to help people and fight back against the fall in a speak, but we're not going to defeat it until the next phase of eternity. Right.
Joshua, thanks, man. Just appreciate your pastoral heart too. And I think this, in these conversations, we can kind of lose sight sometimes of in our attempt to define what is right and wrong. And to, you know, we kind of almost like puff up our chests and be like, well, of course this thing is right or this thing is wrong. And I think there's still pursuit of truth, and that's really important. I think I'm hearing that in you, but there's also a high degree of grace in the complexities that we're all working in right now. Man, last question, which is a little of a side question slash fun one, but I'm gonna riff off about four or five movie titles.
Okay.
And I'm curious to know, out of them, if you think there's one that kind of best describes this kind of moment, this cultural moment that we're in around the world we're living in, this cultural moment as it ties to technology. You might not have seen all of these either, but here's a few that I've been thinking about. So I'll start with the movie Her. Then you've got a movie like The Truman Show. Maybe we're like all getting watched and something's getting created around us, so I don't know, there might be a little bit of that. A little bit of Wall-E. I got two little kids, you know, although they haven't seen that yet, but where kind of everything's going to kind of end pretty bad for us. There's other dystopian, a lot of big dystopian movies out there as well, right? You've got like Terminator, and you know, I was thinking about like iRobot. You know, we were talking about that, mentioned that earlier, where, you know, that we're going to get down this line and robots are essentially going to control society and then turn on us. And so I know I'm curious to know, like, again, a lot of these are dystopian in their nature. I don't know if any of those movies grab you and go, okay, yeah, that's a useful way of thinking about things right now culturally, because I think, too, movies are so often a reflection of our society in terms of how we're thinking or how culture is trying to process the way we're viewing the world.
Yeah. Well, I think they all have something important to say. I'm a fan of all of them in different regards for different reasons. So I don't know if that's a political answer, but there are aspects of each one of them when they came out that I really liked. And I'm a big film person. I love media. I'm not anti-tech at all. So I love just being engrossed in a story and when it's communicated well. And not that I endorse everything about them, but just like, man, I like stories. One that captures it well, we really like Wall-E at my house. And I mean, of course it's a kid's movie. It's an exaggeration, but I think as far as like the political commentary on how we use automation, robots and stuff, like, I think think it's pretty good analysis of where we're headed. Maybe not on that scale, hopefully. But even my daughter, just to brag a little bit on her, 7 years old, she's like, this movie is about when we don't take care of the planet. And I was like, man, that's a pretty mature analysis of what the movie's about, you know. And there's almost no dialogue in the movie. There's no like silly songs. So just like, if I'm going to watch something over and over again, I think that has a lot of value to it. Because as we know, kids, they do not get bored with something they like as quickly. And there's a lot of beauty to that, and a lot of gospel truth to it. Yeah, but I think Wally gets it as far as the environmental crisis that we're in and headed towards, even just with how we use electricity. But then the other movies, like they nail a lot too. The movie Her was really touching in a lot of ways, because you see there is a community of people who are struggling to find intimacy and connection and love, which is a very it's just a basic fundamental need that we have from childbirth forward till we die is to be loved, affirmed, connected. And you see people who connect and right there's whole parts of Tokyo, I believe it is, that you know you can not interact with another human. You can have a girlfriend or boyfriend that is a chat bot or a robot or whatever. And so that kind of points to me, not something that's necessarily wrong with that person, because I think that desire to be connected and to be loved is a very good and biblical thing. It's just like we were saying earlier about, okay, well, let's design something to kind of fill that need instead of saying, okay, well, is there a better way to meet this? Yeah, there's a better way. Like you're probably sitting 400 feet from somebody, you know, but that's much harder, right? And so I think Her speaks into that dilemma and about finding love in a modern age. And there's all kind of movies about that too. And I could go on and on and on, James, about all these movies. They're so good.
Well, there we go. My conversation with Joshua K. Smith. Joshua, thanks so much, brother, for taking the time to chat with me. If you guys want to keep these conversations going, man, I super deeply encourage you connect with a faith tech community locally or online. Obviously, with my conversation with Joshua, the value of embodiment and being with others in person. This is why we want to see faith tech communities meeting together in person all around the world. And so I really encourage you to connect in and find a way to loop into a community or maybe start your own. Maybe there's others in your city and you don't have a local faith tech community and you're like, we need others thinking, talking, building, creating together with this redemptive vision of technology. And then again, if you guys can share this, leave a review or send it to a friend. We're just getting this going. That would go super long way in helping more people hear these important conversations like mine with Joshua K. Smith. Peace out. Love you guys. Bye.